Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The sound of Paganini. But when it's a 9-year-old Sarah Chang on a quarter-sized violin playing music most violinists never master at any age, then it's the sound of...
super genius.
Genius, the mystery in plain sight.
A genius is a visionary thinker.
My brother can pick up anything, read it, and know it backwards and forwards.
That's really what makes him a true genius.
Unlocking the genius in all of us. Who has the key?
Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
Genius for everybody. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. You're listening to The Takeaway. Of course, you're a genius. It's Tuesday, March 9th. Todd Zwillick joins me today. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
The Takeaway today really is unlocking this mystery of genius, making it less mystifying and more sort of democratic. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And we're going to get to the bottom of what genius really is. But first, let's check on some of the morning's top news. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar this morning. He's there with NATO commanders reviewing plans to push the Taliban out of the city in the coming months. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with Colonel David Lamb, who spent several years commanding troops in Afghanistan. He told us the city represents a major test.
Kandahar is a major city of 850,000 people. It is really the spiritual heart of the Taliban inside Afghanistan.
Now, Lamb says he expects any offensive to begin when the reinforcement of U.S. troops is complete.
President Obama is trying to rally his party and the public as the health care reform bill nears a vote in the House. During a stop near Philadelphia yesterday, the president sharpened his attack against Republicans.
I got all my Republican colleagues out there saying, well, no. We want to focus on things like cost. You had 10 years. What happened? What were you doing?
President says he's hoping for a final vote within the next 10 days. Senate Democrats need at least one Republican vote today to keep a bill extending jobless benefits moving. It would also restore about 60 popular tax breaks that expired last year. Today's vote is to limit debate on the measure, cutting off possible filibuster efforts. New polling suggests that 2/3 of African-American adults plan to vote in this year's election. And there are several reasons for the expected increase in turnout, but one may be that Hispanic and black businesses are receiving a disproportionately small number of federal stimulus contracts. For more, we're joined by Richard Copeland, founder and CEO of Thor Construction Companies, the world's largest African-American-owned construction company. Richard, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, the stats are actually pretty disturbing, that African-American and Hispanic-owned businesses have been disproportionately not represented in the stimulus money, and you're the world's largest African-American-owned construction company. I would think this would be a bonanza for you.
You would think so, wouldn't you? Well, it's atrocious what's going on in this nation. The country's caught a bad cold. We're dying of pneumonia.
And we're going to talk about what that has meant on projects that you're working on around the country, and specifically in the kinds of people who haven't been hired because of these bad statistics. Richard Copeland, stay with us. Richard Copeland is founder and CEO of Thor Construction Companies. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down at this hour. Futures on Wall Street are slumping. The Dow gets underway at 10,552. The S&P opens at 1,138, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Coming up this hour, our week-long series on genius continues today. You can catch up on our website, thetakeaway.org. It's all about the genius in all of us, a book by David Shank, who's been co-curating our series. Todd, you know, what if you were a genius at one thing, what would it be?
Oh, God. If I were a genius at one thing, I think it would be live radio, just the smoothness of it. You know?
So you're a genius at live radio?
If I could be.
That's good. Nothing wrong with that. I think we got to get rid of this sort of intimidation thing about genius. For me, genius? I don't know. I'd love to be a genius in math like the guys back in college, that's for sure. We're going to talk about Sarah Chang, a genius on the violin, later this hour. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, stimulus and African-American contracts. Good morning, everyone. I'm joined by Todd Zwillick down in Washington, D.C., and we're trying to unravel the mystery all week long of genius in America and everywhere. It's not just a gift that sort of lands, and that's the end of it. It's actually something that can be nurtured. It's something that has interesting dynamics. And Todd, you're a genius, right?
Yeah, I wish.
Yeah,
thanks, John.
A genius in radio. He aspires to be a genius in radio. That's why we have him co-hosting the show. For the poor Celeste Headlee, who's home with the takeaway virus that has been just bringing everybody down over the last several weeks. I actually had it last week. But it doesn't matter if you're a genius or not. If you're an African-American or Hispanic contractor, you have not benefited from the stimulus money proportionately to the rest of the contractors in America. My next two guests are all about this issue and what it means for communities around the nation. Laura Barrett is the executive director of the Transportation Equity Network. She says that while Black and Latino communities have been harder hit by the recession, they are receiving proportionately fewer of the stimulus project contracts doled out by the government. And also returning is Richard Copeland in Minneapolis. He's the founder and CEO of Thor Construction Companies, the nation's largest African-American-owned construction company. Good morning to you, Richard and Laura.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you know, I'm a little naive here, Richard. I would have thought that in federal contracts, in the public sector, that there would be all kinds of preferences and sort of maybe not affirmative action, but sort of minority-owned preferences that would have helped companies like you. But you say the stimulus package has not worked that way at all.
Well, of course, no, it has not worked that way because the money doesn't trickle down through the economy like it should, especially in the federal money's been earmarked for highway departments across this country, and the good old boy network is alive and well in those institutions.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Laura Barrett, does the concept of shovel ready become an excuse to go with one contractor over another and favor what Richard is calling the old boy network?
Yeah, I think that basically highway departments had gotten together their wish list before we started having seen the money spent. And it included a lot of projects that were in the exurbs. It included old boy networks and contractors that had been their favorites for years. And it also included highway projects versus transit projects.
Uh-huh.
So there's a whole bunch of problems with it that ignored the huge need in our communities to start to get folks back to work and actually lift up some of the minority contractors, some of the women contractors, some of the Latino contractors who are out there who really need these contracts. And, you know, Obama came into office, he was talking about change. We have not seen a change. We've just seen a reinforcement of the old patterns that were already out there.
So what you're seeing is a case of an emergency causes people to throw maybe some of these more socially progressive ideas out the window and say it's too much of an emergency right now. We can't be bothering with these sorts of things. Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, but it also was this huge opportunity to really try to do things differently, and there was not enough thought put into that in the beginning. You see Secretary LaHood making some motions around that now, sending out a letter to the state governors recommending unbundling the contracts, setting aside $20 million in subsidies, more money in short-term loans and grants, which is great, and we congratulate Secretary LaHood on doing that. But we've really got to think about this stuff before it gets out on the road, and if we're going to include folks from the communities, minority and women contractors, as well as making sure that most of the work hours go to low-income people and minorities, we have to put some thoughtfulness in the beginning. In Missouri, there was a huge highway project that was going right through the city of St. Louis, through many minority neighborhoods. Activists from MCU, Metropolitan Congregations United, and many minority contractors in the area got together and decided, let's take advantage of this opportunity. They formed a campaign, got some demands in front of MoDOT, which included 30% of the work hours being set aside for low-income people.
MoDOT is Missouri Department of Transportation?
Exactly.
All right.
And the whole project worked. It was just completed in December. Almost 27% of the work hours went to low-income people, raised up quite a few people in our area, people in even advanced a journeyman status through the carrying out of this project. And also the community was intricately involved in the whole thing from day one.
Well, that's
and
a great,
we are still monitoring the project.
That's a great story, and we should point out the Transportation Equity Network that Laura Barrett is the executive director of is calling for complete and publicly accessible demographic information on all contracts and jobs financed by the stimulus. Richard Copeland at Thor Construction Company in Minneapolis, what do you want to do as a contract that you've been unable to do because this money has sort of sailed over your head?
Well, we'd like Laura's saying, we need access to the dollars. We've got to get them into our communities, or our communities are starved out and further polarized and excommunicated from the mainstream of this economy. So we need enforcement of the goals and the laws that are on the books currently, and some thought into what's going on before the money's doled out.
But are you seeing specifically a project that you'd love to get your hands on that has actually gone somewhere else during this period?
Well, yeah, but I mean, none of the money went to vertical construction. It all went to horizontal construction, and so and minority contractors thrive in vertical construction.
What does that mean exactly? Just explain it as
buildings versus civil work.
I see. All right. Well, then, you know, both of you are talking about what a lot of people have criticized the stimulus for, not having a lot of really big ideas. Do you think it's possible at this stage in the game, Richard Copeland, to generate a kind of community-based orientation to the distribution of stimulus money? Or is that a state-by-state kind of issue that certain states are going to be able to do it? Missouri's had some success. Could Minneapolis come into this game late?
Well, you know, we are trying. We are trying a grassroots approach to make some systemic change to what's happening, but it might be too little too late.
And, hey, go ahead, Todd.
Well, Laura Burnett, this is Todd Zwillick. I just wanted to ask a quick question. You know, Congress is busy scrambling trying to undo years of discrimination against black farmers who were shut out from subsidies to white farmers. 15 years down the road, could we see similar lawsuits from minority-owned construction companies because of the stimulus?
I think that that's certainly a possibility. I think that what we've really got to do now is half the money has been let. There's still another half to go. Secretary LaHood seems to be paying attention to this now. We've got to make sure that we really change things at this point, start keeping careful track of the data. Where is where are the contracts actually going? Who's actually working? What are the number of work hours they're working? That kind of stuff can be done right
greater,
now.
Greater sensitivity to demographics and the handing out of stimulus money and what Laura Barrett and Richard Copeland are both talking about, maybe greater vision in targeting stimulus money to benefit particular communities, low-income communities affected by the recession. Laura Barrett, Executive Director of the Transportation Equity Network. Richard Copeland, Founder and CEO of Thor Construction Company. Thanks to you both.
Bye now.
All right, at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check out on some other stories we're following. Todd?
President Obama, John, turned up the volume on health care yesterday at a rally near Philadelphia. He set up the insurance companies as his main target.
How much higher do premiums have to rise until we do something about it? How many more Americans have to lose their health insurance? How many more businesses have to drop coverage?
Now, the president also criticized Republicans for holding up reform, but Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, says Americans want reform plans rewritten. The vice president, meanwhile, Joe Biden, is in Israel. Today he meets with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Biden says the door is open for peace.
I think we are at a moment of real opportunity.
The vice president is making the highest level visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories by a member of the Obama administration so far.
Another story out of Israel. A government minister there says the government wants to build a nuclear power plant to produce electricity. The minister speaking in Paris said Israel would actually develop nuclear energy in cooperation with scientists and engineers from what he called Israel's Arab neighbors. Israel is facing a crisis over electricity supplies. One of two Baptist missionaries accused of kidnapping in Haiti is back in the U.S. Teresa Coulter was freed by a judge. The leader of the group, Laura Silsby, remains in the Haitian capital. And last night, UConn's women's basketball team broke an NCAA record when they scored, their 71st straight win in a game against Notre Dame. The score, 59-44. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, Ibrahim Abdelmateen with drama in the L.A. Lakers.
We'll be right back. Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for Celeste, and I'm joining John, of course. Time for some takeouts on the stories that we're following this morning. First up...
The most precious thing in the world is the financial security and well-being of your family. Know that you've left them with peace of mind. Nowadays, we all know that cash rules everything around us. Cream, get the money, dollar, dollar bill, y'all.
That would probably be a little risky to invest with Wu-Tang Financial.
Wu-Tang Financial, yes.
From the Chappelle Show.
Dave Chappelle's hedge fund, yes.
Yeah, that's right, on Comedy Central. I think the Riz's financial advice there, John, was diversify your bonds. I think that was the extent of financial advice from Wu-Tang Financial, if I recall. But
dollar bill, y'all. Yeah.
Dollar bill, y'all. There's a financial diversification of a different sort going on in the real world of Wall Street. And Louis Story, Wall Street and Finance reporter from our partner, The New York Times, is here to tell us about it. Louise, apparently state and federal governments are taking very different approaches than private companies in how they're investing, right? They're not taking the Riz's advice.
Right, Todd. It's very interesting. Companies, by and large, have been pulling their pension plans for their workers out of the stock market, saying, you know, the stock market's not safe enough. Think of these huge swings we've all seen in the stock market. And so they're getting safer and they're going more into corporate bonds where it doesn't really matter what the prices do because they'll hold them to maturity and just get the interest rate payments. So companies are getting safer with the pension plans for their workers. States, on the other hand, are going into far riskier things. They're going into derivatives. They're going into hedge funds. They're increasing their stock holdings. They're looking to all kinds of creative leveraged investments because they don't have enough money in their pension. And, you know, as one person put it in an article we have today in the New York Times, in effect, they're going to Las Vegas.
Oh, so these are government employees, pension funds.
That's right.
Trying to play catch up in the market.
That's right. Well, see, the problem is these numbers are striking. The problem is that they're assuming in their formulas that they're going to make 8% every year in their investments. And in those assumptions, they're assuming 9.5% annual return on their stocks. Now, just think for a minute. We keep talking about passing 10,000 on this show. You know, you pass it, you go under it, you pass it, you go under it. Remember, the first time that happened was in 99. The stock market is not yielding 9.5% year after year. In fact, public pension plans investments have only been yielding 3% a year. So it's leading to a big shortfall.
And it sounds like states are almost assuming Madoff levels of return from these hedge funds and derivatives. Louise, who is the greater symbol of stability here? If private corporations are pulling out of the stock market and states are staying in, what's the ripple effect on confidence for everybody else? Like, who do they follow here?
Well, the thing about the state pension funds is that their shortfalls are kind of hidden. One thing that's very interesting, Colorado is one of the very few states to tell us that if they lowered their return assumptions, how much their shortfall would grow. So, for instance, they've said publicly they're assuming an 8.5% return, and that gives them a $17.9 billion shortfall. But they say if they lower that assumption only a 0.5%, then the shortfall goes from $17.9 billion to $21 billion. So they're showing us just a 0.5% would jump it, but most states keep it very hidden, you know, and they're doing these creative things. North Carolina just passed a rule that will let them get into commodities. Wisconsin's getting into derivatives. And, you know, California, we've heard a lot because CalPERS, their pension fund out there, has been very aggressive getting into private equity investments, which lost them a lot of money.
All right. States in financial dire straits trying to find new ways to make money in the market, and they might consider taking the advice of Wu-Tang Financial, their Louise Story reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thank you.
That might be a conservative option based on what Louise is saying there. Now for our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We've been doing a lot of L.A. coverage over the past few days. There was the run-up to the Oscars, the Oscar winners, the Oscar parties. Ibrahim, you have a nomination of your own. It's not best drama. It's most drama. And the winner there in L.A.?
The winner is the Los Angeles Lakers. Oh. And some might think, well, the Lakers are primed to win their next NBA championship in a row. They won last year.
They're a machine, not a soap opera.
They're a machine. They're the most talented team. Their coach is the Zen master, Phil Jackson. But there's also there's something bubbling underneath the surface. And it started to appear this year with Kobe's injuries. He hurt his one of his index finger, and he started to play, his level of play diminished slightly. But there's been also this backstory with Lamar Odom, who's been on a reality TV show with Khloe Kardashian. He's not playing.
He's married into the Kardashian.
He married into
empire, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And his numbers have diminished, and he's also not as focused on the court, and you can see it. And the Lakers won last year because they had incredible bench play. And when you have guys like Sasha Vujacic, who's also has this high-profile romance with Maria Sharapova, who's not playing the best tennis in the world, even though she's one of the higher, you know, she's been touted as one of the better tennis players. I think they're just a distracted team, and that's playing out on the court.
Well, let's get back to Odom in just a moment. But you've got you've got Sasha, who's dating Maria Sharapova. You've got Ron Artest, who's acting out, reminding me a little bit of the Dennis Rodman.
Correct. He's doing his own Dennis Rodman impression, and I think that he was itching to go to L.A. He was itching to go to L.A. from Houston last year, and you wonder why. What did he want to do? But, you know, I like Ron Artest. I like his game. I like his style. He does want to win the championship. He took a pay cut, but it doesn't seem like he's playing with that same kind of with that focus and that drive that he has when he's the man on the team.
It's got to be hard for the Lakers, though. I mean, they win constantly. They're perennially a dynasty. They've got, Phil Jackson. I mean, it must be hard for them. Spring comes around, and they go, oh, here we go. Playoffs again. We got to win.
We got to go win. Exactly. And, you know, for guys like Lamar Odom, Kobe Bryant, Gasol, you're right. They're primed to win another championship. I just don't know if they have exactly what it takes to do it this year.
Well, you have a personal connection with Lamar Odom. How would he get it up, get his sort of focus back for a moment like this?
I think he just has to remember where he came from. He's a hardworking guy, and he has to remember that focus, that drive that got him to this point.
So think NBA, not Kardashian. NBA, not Kardashian.
Exactly. There we go.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much. Coming up with the Oscars this weekend, all eyes were on Hollywood. There are some states trying to create their own Tinseltown. How offering state tax credits for filmmakers is creating all kinds of controversy. Does it pay? We'll find out in a few minutes.
Hi, good morning. Todd Zwillick here, filling in for Celeste, who has the takeaway virus that fell John Hockenberry just a few days ago. But
takeaway one and one, yeah.
Well, we've got her covered, at least for the moment. Well, coming up, it's great when a movie is filmed in your hometown, right? Trust me, in Washington, they're filming them all the time. But the move to get Hollywood into your state through tax credits is causing quite a drama. This is a story from Massachusetts, and we'll explain in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on some of the top stories we're following at 31 minutes past the hour. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in the spiritual heart and birthplace of the Taliban this morning, the southern Afghan city of Kandahar. Here's where he's there with NATO commanders reviewing plans to push the Taliban out of the city in coming months. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with Colonel David Lamb, who spent several years commanding troops in Afghanistan. He says the Afghan government can project itself as a custodian of holy areas like Kandahar.
It can over time, but I would say at the present time, the Taliban owns that mantra.
Now, Lamb says he expects any offensive to begin once the surge of U.S. troops is complete in the summer. Here at home, meanwhile, the percentage of American workers with virtually no retirement savings is up for the third straight year. 43% of workers have less than $10,000 in savings. The survey also found American workers who have less than $1,000 saved jumped from 20% in 2009 to 27% now.
Hand-to-mouth America. So the magnitude 8.8 earthquake that shook Chile last month was strong enough to move, get this, Todd, the entire city of Concepcion, that's down there near the coast, near the epicenter, 10 feet to the west. NASA made the finding after checking its GPS measurements. They've already said the quake shifted the Earth's axis enough to create slightly shorter days. Have you noticed?
Sunset's coming earlier.
A 10,000th of a second, something like that. In the theater world, they're awaiting tonight's London premiere of Love Never Dies, the sequel to Andrew Lloyd Webber's global hit Phantom of the Opera.
And listen to the music of the night.
Oh, man, that guy is in a rut. But hey, Phantom has been seen by 100 million people around the world. The sequel picks up the story 10 years later with the Phantom relocated to the bright lights of New York's Coney Island. The show's been trashed by some internet reviews. It's scheduled to open on Broadway in November. Let's check the markets. Asian markets are mixed. European indices are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,552. The S&P opens at 1,138. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,332. Andrew Lloyd Webber, he's a genius. What am I saying? What am I saying? Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hollywood is coming to Massachusetts, ladies and gentlemen.
We are duly appointed federal marshals.
But during your stay, you will obey protocol. Gentlemen, welcome to Shutter Island.
Welcome to Shutter Island, and welcome to Massachusetts, where since 2006, tax incentives have been luring movie makers like Martin Scorsese, apparently looking to save some money. But since then, nearly 40 major films have been shot in the state of Massachusetts. A number of other states have adopted similar programs, too, as the competition for film companies grows. But there's a question about whether they're costing taxpayers more than they're actually bringing into the public coffers. Now, in a moment, we'll hear from Joe Maiella. He's president of the Massachusetts Production Coalition. But first, we're joined by Joan Fitzgerald. She's the director and a professor of the graduate program at the Northeastern University, at the Law Center at Northeastern University. She's crunched some numbers on the policy. Joan, good morning. I'm thinking of movies like Good Will Hunting, Mystic River 2003, set in South Boston. Now we have Shutter Island coming out with Leonardo DiCaprio, all set in Boston, in or around Boston. You're saying this is not a moneymaker for Massachusetts. Why not?
Well, let's start with the Massachusetts Department of Revenue's own study. It showed that Massachusetts spent about $94,000 in credits per full-time job created. Thing is, those jobs are temporary jobs. So even if someone's making $68,000 with benefits, that's good, but they're temporary and they're paying more per job than is being generated. Or you can measure the success in tax revenues generated. Massachusetts gets about 16 cents on every dollar it invests. So as more states start offering subsidies, and now I think it's up to 46 do, the amount of competition for a limited number of projects intensifies. So each state ups the ante. We've gone from sales tax exemptions to income tax credits to interest-free loans. And so what we're starting to see now is that many states that jumped in earlier are cutting back because their studies are showing it's not paying off. Good job.
Well, Joan Fitzgerald.
Yes.
I just want you to hear from Richard Cambria from Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Yesterday, one of our producers talked with Richard Cambria. He recently worked on the set of Night and Day with Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz. Now, he was out of work until he got hired on a film. And listen to what he has to say. Listen to this.
In the winter of 2007, construction just went completely dead in my area, and I got laid off. And a friend of mine told me he could get me a job as a film industry prop maker and ended up with a good job that filled the hole of having no construction work in Massachusetts. And without this job, I would have been in dire straits.
Now, there's Joan Fitzgerald, there's one worker who got a job on a film set and said he would have been in dire straits, but you're saying one worker does not make good policy.
Right. From the perspective of a worker who got one of the jobs on a production set, of course, it means the difference between paying a mortgage or not. I get that. But it's a different question for the state. It's under what conditions should the public sector subsidize the private sector to create jobs? And I would argue that the conditions are when you're laying the groundwork for future rounds of economic development. Not when you are subsidizing temporary jobs. 40% of those jobs, of the wages being subsidized, are to people who live outside the state.
All right. Well,
so
let me turn to
short-term measure.
Let me turn to Joe Maiella because he's president of the Massachusetts Production Coalition. Joe, I've got a good sense that you're going to strongly disagree here.
What makes you think that?
Well, go ahead.
Well, look, you know, the points that we want to make and make clear is that over the last 4 years, this program has brought in $1.069 billion of new direct spending into the Commonwealth at a time when Massachusetts needed it the most. The jobs increase during that period has been 117% when total state employment has been on the decline. We know in the reports, including the UMass reports, say that for every new job that this generates, it generates 0.79 other new jobs. For every new dollar it generates, about 95% of additional new spending is generated. The benefits to cities and towns not even counted in the DOR report include things like almost $1 million directly to Essex in both infrastructure improvements as well as location fees paid to the town, allowed them to put $150,000 into their stabilization fund and to help avoid an override But
Joe Maiella, it sounds like Joan Fitzgerald's point is all those numbers are well and good, but that they're not as effective as other kinds of stimulus, and you could create many more jobs much more cheaply without doing it in the film industry.
What we know and what we've seen and what the DOR reports as well is that unlike other tax credits, this program actually requires those people who are coming into the Commonwealth to spend their money first before any tax credits are issued. That's unlike other tax programs where you put the money out there first for the promise of new jobs. And we've seen other sectors where the money has gone out and those new jobs have never arrived. So we see this as a very responsible way of getting the benefit of all of that new direct spending first before any tax credits are issued. And in fact, over the first 3 years of the program, even though, you know, you're judging it on, some of our critics will judge it just on tax revenue generated, that's an upside-down analysis. This program was never designed to generate more tax revenue than the investment being made.
That's the analysis. We love the films. You guys worry about the money. Joe Maiella, president of the Massachusetts Production Coalition, joined us. Joan Fitzgerald from Northeastern University. Thanks to you both.
And now a look at a story with important international implications, which you may have missed.
I wish to express our concern for the tragic loss of life in Nigeria. We continue to urge all parties to exercise restraint and seek constructive means for addressing the cycle of violence in Plateau State.
That's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton referring to both the U.S. government and the Human Rights Watch calling for an inquiry into an upsurge of killing in the Nigerian city of Jos over the weekend. The clashes, which left hundreds of people dead, were between Christian and Muslim villagers. Joining me from the Nigerian capital is Ahmed Idris. He's the editor of the BBC's Abuja Bureau in Nigeria. Good morning, Ahmed.
Hi, good morning. It's afternoon here.
Of course. So give us the context of this unrest and how it is related or unrelated to the kind of instability we hear a lot about from Nigeria.
Well, the current crisis in Jos is it's being regarded as a retaliation by some people who think that they have been attacked in the last disturbance in January. You remember the last time there was violence in Jos was in January, on January 17th to be precise, and then hundreds of people were killed. And now what is making round in Nigeria now is that this is a retaliatory attack in Jos Plateau State. And this is not the first time. Over the last 10 years, there have been such attacks, I think, three or four times. This is the fourth one.
Has the Nigerian government been keeping the lid on this particular area so it's difficult to actually figure out what's going on, and how effective have they been in quelling this violence?
Well, the immediate step the Nigerian government takes immediately when situations like this happen is to send in the military, because the police have proved to be ineffective so far in quelling religious and ethnic disturbances in Nigeria. And this time around, the military has been sent to parts of Plateau State affected by the current violence. And what the government follows up with is usually setting up an investigative panel. We've been hearing about these panels for more than 20 years now, and nobody has acted on any of the reports put forth by such committees. Even the current disturbance, even the last disturbance, they were investigating the causes of those disturbances, and nobody has come up with an idea on how to tackle this problem at all.
Ahmed Idris, editor of the BBC's Abuja Bureau in Nigeria. Finally, how has this possibly provoked something of a presidential crisis in Nigeria?
Well, come again. I didn't get the last one.
Well, dispute between the acting president in Nigeria and the president in Nigeria over this particular issue. It seems the timing of these disturbances has been particularly unfavorable.
Absolutely. Yesterday, the acting president sacked the national security advisor, who was appointed by the president, the ailing president, that's Musa Eradua. And nobody knows if Eradua happens to return to power, how he's going to take this. Maybe he can effect some changes. And the current national security advisor actually did stand for the election in 2007 along with Eradua. And I don't think it will sit down well with Eradua if he happens to return to power.
And, of course, anything that bears on the stability or instability of Nigeria has a relationship to the oil markets all around the world. Ahmed Idris, editor of the BBC Bureau in Abuja, Nigeria, where he joined us from. Thanks so much, Ahmed.
It is intelligence, which is the ability to learn from experience.
Exercising parts of our brain.
What sounds to you like a big load of trashy old noise is, in fact, the brilliant music of a genius, myself.
Now, you got that right, Iggy Pop, the work of a genius. He had help from another genius in his life. That would be one David Bowie. But maybe that's a story for another day. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here for Celeste Headlee. And I'm here with genius John Hockenberry. Coming up as part of
Super genius.
Super genius John Hockenberry. We have a week-long series on geniuses. And we've been hearing from you on the geniuses in your life at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Oh, this is Jeff calling from Andover, Massachusetts. I really think Herb Spivak is a genius. He's made it so that New Balance can make shoes in Massachusetts and Maine and got the labor cost differential between China and these factories here down to $2.50 a pair of shoes, which is nothing.
Now, that's the story of a business genius, but coming up, we'll hear from a musical genius, that's violinist Sarah Chang, in just a few moments. Now, right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. There's a key test vote in the Senate today on extending unemployment insurance. The measure would provide weekly unemployment checks averaging around $300 to people whose benefits have run out. The bill would also extend health insurance subsidies for the unemployed. Ohio State University, meanwhile, says one of its employees was killed and two others were wounded at an overnight shooting at a campus maintenance building. The university says no students were involved in the incident. A man has been taken into custody.
Vice President Joe Biden is in Israel today. He says the door is open for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. In a speech this morning, he said now is a moment of real opportunity after the two sides agreed to resume indirect talks. Here's an unusual story from overseas. Japan has confirmed it secretly struck military deals with the U.S. during the Cold War that allowed nuclear-armed American warships into Japanese ports. The deals, denied by previous Japanese governments, violated Japan's non-nuclear principles, which were established after the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Finally, beverage companies say they've halted sales of many sugary drinks to schools. Susan Neely, CEO of the American Beverage Association, explains.
America's leading beverage companies have slashed calories from beverages in schools by 88%.
The sugary drinks have been replaced by fruit juices, water, and reduced calorie drinks. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Hey, Paganini was a genius. But listen to this. This very recording, played by a 9-year-old girl. In fact, her debut album, intimidating, I know, makes you think about what you were doing at 9 years old. But don't feel too bad, because today on The Takeaway, we're going to talk about how we can all tap into the extraordinary abilities that come with genius. Celeste Headlee spoke with Sarah Chang, the young woman who played that lovely music. She's now 29. And she also spoke, as we're doing this week, with David Shank, author of The Genius in All of Us, Why Everything You've Been Told About Genetics, Talent, and IQ Is Wrong. Celeste was most interested in Sarah Chang's early days.
So, Sarah, what we just heard is a surprisingly mature sound. But it's also just the sheer technical accomplishment of that is amazing. And I'm wondering what it was like for you the first time you heard somebody call you a genius.
You know what, actually, that recording was made when I was 9, and I was on a quarter-sized violin. So I remember everybody making a really big deal about the fact that I was so young and the instrument was, you know, ridiculously small. So I do remember all of that. I also remember this Newsweek article that ran, and for some reason I was included in it, and they declared, you know, that I was a genius. And I remember looking at that thinking, this is a mistake.
Oh, that's really interesting. Do you consider yourself, do you think of yourself as a genius?
No, God, no. No, of course not. No, it makes me laugh. No, of course not. No, I just think that I was very, very lucky to find my path very early in life, to have one focused goal, and to have the right team of people around me who were really looking out for me long term. I think in the music industry, it is a wonderful industry, but it's also a very competitive and very unforgiving industry. You know, today's concert needs to be better than yesterday's. And
right.
Even when you're practicing, you know, sometimes, you know, because we're all human, something that worked beautifully yesterday doesn't work today. And that just means that, you know, you sit down and you work on it until, and you, if it means that you cancel whatever you have the rest of the day, and, you know, you block out your schedule and you work on what it is that you need to work on.
It's interesting how matter-of-fact she's talking about this stuff, because there's a whole world of people who think that they're doomed to mediocrity who don't know that it's actually just, at least the steps are that simple, and having that sense that you just have to be better and you're expecting yourself to be a little better every day. And it really can be as simple as that if you're applying yourself.
Sarah, this actually must come up a lot for you, because I know that you work with kids and talk to kids a lot. And I know my own son often, he'll try something out and he'll say, oh, I'm terrible at that. I'm not good at singing. I'm not good at football. But the whole point of the process and the practice is that you're working to get better. I mean, is this kind of this message that you give to kids who look at you and think of that you as unattainable?
Well, the thing is that I do work with a lot of kids. I go to a lot of schools and we do Q&As, and I do talk to them, because not all of them will be musicians, and I realize that, but it's more about exposing them to music and exposing them to enough discipline in any area that they want to focus on. It doesn't have to be music. It can be sports, it can be math, it can be literature, it can be whatever it is, but to focus on one thing that they're particularly good at and to nurture that and to have enough support, because frankly there are a lot of things that I'm really lousy at. I can't drive to save my life, I can't cook to save my life, I mean, there's so many things I can't do. And rather than trying, I would rather focus on what I already know that I am good at and that I can thrive at doing. And I know that's it goes against even what my mother thinks. You know, my mom put me, you know, in gymnastic class and ballet class and horseback riding, equestrian classes. She wanted me to do everything, absolutely everything, and she wanted me to excel at everything. And I personally don't think it works that way. I think you need to focus on one or two things that you're really good at and focus your time and energy on that.
Yeah, I'm sure your mom's really disappointed in you, Sarah.
We all are. We all
ruined all her hopes. You know, I have to ask you, when your debut album came out, Sarah, Yehudi Menuhin is quoted as describing you as the most wonderful, most perfect, most ideal violinist I ever heard. And that's at age 9 or 10. So where do you, I mean, if you actually believed your own press, where would you go from there? There's nowhere to go.
You know what? My parents, I have to hand it to them. They're really good about that. They, for the longest time, until I was in my late teens, they will not let me read any of my reviews. Honestly, they absolutely would not let me read any of my reviews. And I once asked them, why is that? You know, people are talking about my reviews, they're quoting stuff to me, and I would sit there during interviews not knowing what they were talking about because I hadn't read them myself. And they told me, well, if they're good reviews, we don't want you to become this impossible prima donna. And they said, and if it's a bad review, you're so young right now and so vulnerable that we don't want it to affect you and we don't want you to lose focus.
That's your parents are so healthy, and obviously you know how great a job they did at managing at all this balance, which is incredible. But let me just also point out how truly exceptional Sarah is, because what many people out there don't realize is that there's a whole group of what we call child prodigies, which is a word I think is kind of unhelpful in a certain way. And then there's a whole group of people who as adults are great at what they do. And there isn't a heck of a lot of overlap between those groups. An awful lot of child prodigies burn out for a whole variety of reasons. And what we're listening to now is a woman who used to be a girl, who was great as a girl, and who somehow navigated this very, very difficult terrain to become also great as an adult. And there's a whole process to that and a whole trick to it. And it's just it's extraordinary that's happened in this case.
That is some beautiful trick. And of course, that's the voice of my good buddy, David Schenk. He's the author of The Genius in All of Us. We're going to be talking with him all week. He's our companion in our Genius series. Of course, Sarah Chang, classical violinist who recorded her first album at age 9. Listen to her there. Ooh, just a little more. She's 29 now, performing all over the world.
Gorgeous. I almost don't want to talk over it. I guess I have to.
For more on our Genius series. Step on the Genius.
I know. I feel bad about doing it. But we do want you to know that you can read an excerpt from David's book and see audio examples, hear audio examples of Genius throughout history. David will be answering your questions on Genius all week. We're post your questions to thetakeaway.org and we'll publish his answers there as well. So what kind of genius do you want to be? In music, like Sarah Chang, or biology? Salsa dancing? Tell us about it at 8778-MY-TICKER. Post to
to the website at thetakeaway.org.
I mean, the great thing about David Shank's book is that you feel like a genius, or at least like there's a path to you being a genius, and that's what we want to get from all of you. Speaking of geniuses, when we ask you to sum up the news events in just 6 words, you're a genius when you talk about the State of the Union.
I hope we still can.
On second thought, maybe we can't.
Rome wasn't built in a day.
This guy lies through his teeth.
Quit fighting and get the job done.
Our genius listeners, I'm John Hockenberry, joining you from Miami tomorrow.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for Celeste Headley from Washington. It's The Takeaway.